This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Lots of things to think about this hour. It's Nelson Mandela's 95th birthday. And just a few days ago, we might have imagined that the former South African leader would never see this day. Today, people are talking about him perhaps going home from the hospital. We're going to look at the various celebrations of this day of service on the streets of Cape Town and in the heart of one young South African right here in New York. We'll also construct for you an imaginary but very plausible conversation of sorts between a Pakistani terrorist victim, Malala Yousafzai, and a member of the Taliban gang who took credit for shooting her. And finally, at the end of this hour, Patrick Henry Bass helps us all deal with the inner guilt of those books we started but could never finish. A different look at summer reading this hour. But first, he may be there close to the top of the field when the 2016 presidential race gets underway. Republican Senator Rand Paul, junior senator from Kentucky, son of presidential candidate and former Congressman Ron Paul, has a very high profile in the U.S. Senate. He's taken on the administration over its use of predator drones against U.S. citizens. He's been very tough on his own party for its endorsement of the aggressive use of domestic surveillance under the Patriot Act. From his libertarian side, Rand Paul is a tough advocate of smaller government and stated boldly he had no fear of the sequester when it happened earlier this year. His latest issue? Well, he's joining the bandwagon of the Military Justice Improvement Act, a proposal from Paul's Democratic colleague, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, to deal with sexual assault in the military. Gillibrand explained her proposal on this program last May.
Men and women who are attacked don't feel that they can tell their commanding officer. And so one of the solutions that we've put forward is the ability for them to actually report these cases to the JAG attorneys, the prosecutors who will prosecute the case, take the decision-making out of the chain of command so that they're no longer the one who decides whether a case should go to trial or whether to overturn a jury's verdict once a conviction has been made.
Even though Gillibrand's plan does not have the support of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or many others in the GOP, Rand Paul thinks the Pentagon itself is just another example of big government and big authority trampling on the rights and needs of American citizens, in uniform or not. And for Senator Rand Paul, that's a matter of principle.
Well, you know, I'm a physician, and I like to see legislative problems or problems that we have in the country simply as problems without a partisan nature. I try to, can't say that I'm never a partisan, but I try to see things in a bipartisan or nonpartisan way. And in the military, as Senator Gillibrand describes the problem, it appears that people who have suffered from sexual assault aren't reporting the problem because they may fear who they report it to. I think the idea of having it outside your chain of command is probably a good idea.
Now, of course, many in the military, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, says breaking up the command structure would be way too disruptive. What's your response to that?
You know, I've talked to people in my state, some of whom are judges, some of whom are Marines, and asked them about this. And their first impression was that it might. And then we talked further and we looked at the bill. And one of the things we were concerned about was that disobeying an order would go outside of the chain of command. And we thought that was wrong. If a colonel tells a captain what to do and the captain doesn't obey, we really don't need a lawyer in the middle of that. And so we asked Senator Gillibrand if she'd take out disobeying an order. So she agreed to take that out. And I think that should help some of the people in the military who worry about having a lawyer involved in every command decision.
You took very strong positions on the president being asked if U.S. citizens were going to be targeted in drone strikes, a controversy earlier this year. You talked very strongly about issues of domestic surveillance in the United States. I'd love to hear some of those comments reiterated here. But in general, do you think there is a broad bipartisan consensus growing in the United States on these issues of government intrusion into people's lives?
Well, I think it's growing, but it's very small. Unfortunately, the bipartisan consensus with almost no disagreement among Republicans and Democrats is for domestic surveillance without many restrictions at all. The head of the FBI recently announced that they have domestic drones. This was to the surprise of most of us. I have had no indication that they were using drones, and he said, yes, they were using them. And he was asked, well, do you have any kind of privacy guidelines to keep you from invading people's privacy? He says, we're working on them. That was kind of shocking. They're using the drones and don't yet have their guidelines in place. And so we sent a question to the head of the FBI. We said, are you getting search warrants before you use a domestic drone for surveillance? And are you arming these drones, or do you have plans to arm these drones? And how many drones do you have, and how long have you been using them? And they refused to answer us. So this has been going on for nearly a month now. We've gotten no answers from the FBI. They're also talking about maybe their answers are going to be classified. Well, if they classify their answers, whether they're using a warrant or not, or how they're using it, then they forbid me from talking about it. So really, this needs to be an open discussion. There's no reason it should be classified, talking about whether or not we're going to obey the Bill of Rights when we do surveillance of individuals.
Traditional Republicans argue that, at least traditional contemporary conservative Republicans argue that the United States government is a far too big intruder in the U.S. economy. It sounds like you're saying there's also a parallel argument that because of our national security apparatus, that there is an intrusion into American civil life that is a result of growing government in the security zone. Do you think the two arguments are parallel?
Absolutely. And I think the consistent argument, you know, is for less government involvement in the economy, but also less in our personal and private lives. And I think one of the things that, you know, people have said, well, this NSA leak has sort of jeopardized our national security. I think sort of the opposite. I think the fact that we've had the intelligence director lie to us about the program really does more to jeopardize our security, because now we've lost faith. We've lost faith in the intelligence community that they will tell either Congress or the American people the truth. And I think really the only thing shocking, or the only thing that's been divulged here, is not that we're spying on terrorists. I think most terrorists in the world are swapping out phones and know that we are listening to their phone calls and watching them on the internet. The surprise really here is that we're watching Americans, innocent Americans, to the tune of hundreds of millions of American cell phones, tracking all that data without an individualized warrant, without probable cause. And I find that very, very disconcerting.
You've talked about your frustration with what you say are lies from the national security apparatus, even to members of Congress. In your endorsement of the Gillibrand bill, you're essentially talking about encouraging whistleblowing of sexual assault by victims within the military, even outside the chain of command. I'm wondering if there's a whistleblowing issue at work in the national security establishment. Would you consider Snowden, whistleblower Ed Snowden, a hero?
You know, I think it's unknown, and history will kind of, it's kind of the question still remains how he'll be judged in history. And I think it's more difficult for him now because he's, you know, seems to be taking residence with people who have been traditionally our opponents and at times our enemies. So I think it's more and more difficult. But I think the issue is an incredibly important one. The other thing about it that people need to remember with these leaks, it's not like there's been some kind of computer code leaked that could damage our national intelligence gathering. What's been leaked is basically a program that's been talked about on the ACLU website for over a year. I've talked about it indirectly in Las Vegas a year ago. I said that a gazillion of your communications are being looked at. And the reason I use the word gazillion is because it's not a real word. And I can use that because it's classified what the exact number is. So really, there wasn't so much a secret. But what was pointed out, though, is just how much of an abuse. Now you have authors of the Patriot Act saying, you know what? Even though I supported the Patriot Act, I never thought they would use one single warrant to get a billion phone records. And that really goes against the grain of the Fourth Amendment and everything that we stand for. And it shouldn't be decided by a secret court, by FISA. It should be decided in public by the Supreme Court. And my hope is that the ACLU and other organizations will get out there and we will actually have a public decision on this at the Supreme Court level.
Talking with the Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, and as we learned, friend of the ACLU. So you're not going to judge him. You're going to let history judge whether Ed Snowden is a hero or not. But it certainly sounds like he's helping you make your argument.
Well, I think what's come of this is something very important, is that really we should not allow public officials, high government officials, to lie to Congress. I mean, all the time in committee, people tell me, oh, I can't comment on that in this particular setting. And we accept that there are certain things they will not comment on in public. But it's not acceptable simply to lie to us because it's a public hearing.
Finally, Senator Paul, there's lots of discussion, of course, in Washington and around the country about possible presidential aspirations for you. In that context, let me return to the comments that we were discussing regarding the notion of economic intrusion by the federal government versus national security intrusion by the federal government. The mainstream Republican position seems to be very hard on security, endorsing domestic surveillance by many, but very, very hard on reducing the size of the federal government economically. Do you think that's a contradiction to say one should grow and the other should shrink when you say both should shrink?
I think there is a contradiction, but I think also public opinion and opinion within parties and the shape of parties evolve over time. You know, in the last month, you've seen President Obama's ratings with the youth drop 20 points because he doesn't appear to be defending privacy on the internet. So I think you could conceive of a time when you could have a Republican leader or a Republican nominee who would say, you know, we're the champions of privacy on the internet. We're the champions of the Fourth Amendment. We're the believers in less aggressive war. I mean, look at the potential nominee that they've pointed to, Hillary Clinton, very aggressive with foreign policy, you know, is said to be, was said to be the leading voice for getting involved in the war in Syria, getting involved in the war in Libya. So you might see an interesting switch where Democrats who were once reticent to go to war become the eager folks to go to war. And there might be a branch of the Republican Party that becomes for a strong defense, but more reluctant with regard to foreign adventure.
Sounds like you might be looking to inherit all of those very, very loyal Ron Paul presidential primary supporters in the 2016, eh?
We will see. Haven't made my mind up yet.
Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
One of the oldest and most familiar genetic disorders is Down syndrome, named for British doctor John Langdon Down, who first clinically identified the condition back in 1866. But the famous chromosomal abnormality of Down syndrome, an extra copy of chromosome number 21, was first described much later in 1959 by a whole different set of researchers. Researchers have puzzled over that extra chromosome ever since. Is it the cause of the syndrome, a marker, or the result of something else going on? Well, this week, doctors at the University of Massachusetts Medical School may have solved a big part of this puzzle. Joining us is Dr. Brian Scottco, co-director of the Down Syndrome Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and professor at Harvard Medical School. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you, John, for having me.
So I've puzzled about this as well. The chromosomal abnormality seems, you know, extraordinarily definitive, yet if you think about it for a second, is it the cause? Is it just an indicator of something else that's going on?
Well, Dr. Lawrence and her lab certainly have made a landmark study in the field of Down syndrome. We know that everyone with Down syndrome has an extra copy of that 21st chromosome, but also puzzling, people with Down syndrome are all different in their own unique ways, just like the rest of us are all different. Not everyone with Down syndrome has a heart condition. Not everyone with Down syndrome has thyroid issues. Not everyone with Down syndrome will go on to develop Alzheimer's. So even though they all have that extra chromosome, there is still wide variation in the effects and the symptoms that go along with Down syndrome. What this landmark study, though, shows is that it is possible, at least in a petri dish, to be able to turn off that extra chromosome. And I have to say, over the past decade, we never thought that this would one day be possible, but Dr. Lawrence and her team have shown that perhaps in the future, it is possible.
So there are two elements here. Number one, the sort of switch idea suggests that the chromosomal abnormality is on some level a kind of control mechanism for how Down syndrome develops in people. And secondly, the technology for doing that kind of switching is also a part of the breakthrough.
That's right. We certainly know that overdosage or that extra set of genes on the 21st chromosome is likely contributing to many of the symptoms that go along with Down syndrome. But what these researchers were able to determine through a naturally occurring process in the body is taking something on the X chromosome. There is a gene on the X chromosome that will shut one X chromosome off. Females have two copies of the X chromosome and males have one copy. But in every person, you only need and should be using one copy. So the body naturally has to have a way of shutting down one of those X chromosomes in females. And what Dr. Lawrence and her team did was basically transplant that gene from the X chromosome onto the 21st chromosome, and then they waited to see, would that gene shut down that extra 21st chromosome? And in this landmark paper, they showed, yes, indeed it happened. We are a far way off from therapeutic interventions, but this is the first study to really change the thinking about Down syndrome.
Of course, doctors such as yourself will be thinking strategically about what the implications are outside of the Petri dish. Let me take the perspective of family members and parents who might be thinking about this today. So many parents have the experience of Down syndrome being a condition that appears to be set at birth irrevocably. Is this a switch that could be manipulated in utero? Is this something that could have an early childhood kind of intervention? Or is this a continuing pharmacological therapy of some sort?
And these are all the questions that will be asked next. I think the science has been published today, and certainly the provocative questions are, can this one day be turned into some sort of therapeutic option? And at what stage in development can that be given? Again, we're far ways away, but one could start to imagine, can it be given to adults with Down syndrome, to babies with Down syndrome, to pregnant women who have a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome? But, you know, among the parents that I get to work with and their children with Down syndrome in the Massachusetts General Hospital Down syndrome program, I think this is going to raise the tantalizing question. And that is, can Down syndrome be cured or should Down syndrome be cured? And I think a lot of parents are waking up and going to read this news today and say, wow, this is wonderful news. But I think a lot of parents are also going to pause and say, well, what does this mean for the future of Down syndrome? And what does this mean about my son or daughter who I love just the way he or she is?
Well, you've identified a really interesting component here and give me a sense of the numbers of people who fall into this category. But I suspect that so many of the parents that you deal with, while they're very concerned about the medical future of their child, under no circumstances would want this experience, these characteristics of their child to be erased in any sense, right?
And I think the best spokespeople are people with Down syndrome themselves who have said loud and clear in research and their own advocacy that they feel their lives are valuable. And I had a chance with some researchers to look at people with Down syndrome and ask, how do they feel about their lives? And we learned that 99% of people with Down syndrome state, without question, they're happy with their lives and they like who they are and they like what they do. So certainly the ethical dimensions of a potential cure really need to be kind of consulted with the key stakeholders here, and that's people with Down syndrome and their family members.
You know, it feels like a kind of cochlear implant moment, recalling the experience in the deaf community when that technology was developed.
You're exactly right. I think there's strong parallels of moms and dads who are deaf, who have a child who is deaf, and then need to decide, should they implant a cochlear implant? That is, should they welcome their child into the same culture of people who are deaf, or should they somehow fix and or cure, in some people's words, change their child into another culture, another world? And it brings up the whole culture of disability. You know, people with Down syndrome have certainly their own culture and their unique gifts that they give to their communities. And a future cure, people are asking, well, would the world be bereft of certain positive characteristics that people with Down syndrome contribute to our communities?
Well, it's a fascinating and emotional sort of collision of ethics and science. I can hear it in your voice. Dr. Brian Scottco, thanks so much.
Thank you, John, for having me.
Dr. Brian Scottco is co-director of the Down Syndrome Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and professor at Harvard Medical School. And now a story that has scandalized India. A free school lunch program for poor children may have resulted in the deaths of more than 20 young students, where contaminated ingredients dumped on poor kids with fatal results.
The cook said to me when she was cooking, she pointed out that the oil looked discolored and dodgy. She drew it to the attention of the teacher, who said the oil was homemade and safe to use.
It's the education minister in the state of Bihar, India, where this tragedy took place. Today, thousands of students are reportedly refusing to touch any of the free meals offered out of understandable fear. But the possibility of deliberate contamination, or at least reckless disregard of the safety of children is also being reported as well. Joining us now is Shobha Narayan, freelance journalist based in India. Shobha, welcome.
Thank you.
So what is the nature of the contamination and how did these children die?
As you just said, John, what is being investigated is whether the principal of the school who is absconding had some part to play in this tragedy. A very strange remark was made by the principal secretary of Bihar in a press conference. He said it was a case of poisoning of food and not food poisoning. So after making this remark, he also said that the results of the forensic tests that were being conducted is pending. So as you just said, whether it's reckless disregard or whether it was, God forbid, on purpose, is still being investigated.
And the idea of just simple sanitary conditions, that's completely ruled out. And suddenly this is a big scandal about all sorts of programs that are targeted for the poor.
Correct. I want to emphasize, though, that the midday meal scheme is one of the more successful schemes of India. It was institutionalized in 1981 in my home state of Tamil Nadu when I was growing up there and has since kind of swept across the nation. So in India, while everyone condemns what has happened in Bihar, there's also sort of a pullback saying, hey, this was a tragedy and things need to be done to improve, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. This is a good scheme. It brings children to school on a regular basis. So, yes, we must look into how to make it better. But no, let's not just say abandon the scheme altogether.
Well, and the program itself is an inducement for kids to come to school. So any fear of that food would also have an effect on enrollment at school, I would think, which is really part of the scandal here. How much access do people have to the supply chain of the preparation of these foods? How much standardization of these meals can there be and is there traditionally?
I think going forward there will be, but currently as it stands, schools in rural India, as perhaps with schools everywhere, are totally stretched and there is little or no supervision. My understanding is that sacks of rice and sacks of grains are delivered at the home of the principal of that school, and apparently bottles of insecticide were found in the same kitchen adjoining the food, and I don't know if it just got mixed up by accident or whether there was some more sinister motive. But the sad thing is the lady who cooks the meal, two of her children are dead. So it's very nebulous what has happened, whether the principal, Meena Kumari is her name, and she is absconding, and whether it was just a larger political play or is it just her or is it negligence? Until motive is established, I think it's very hard to say.
And it doesn't alter the tragedy at all, but it is fairly clear that this contamination is confined to this one location.
Correct. But now I think what this tragedy has done is throw light to how lax the supervision is for schools, midday meal schemes all over India. In general, what ends up happening, I think, in Bihar and other places is that the ingredients are kept in a shed and sort of ad hoc cooked in the school itself, and there's no testing. I mean, this is not rocket science. It should be easy to do.
Speaking to us from Bangalore, India, Shobha Narayan is a freelance journalist based in India on the tragic deaths of more than 20 young students who apparently succumbed to the effects of contaminated food in a free school lunch program. Shobha, thanks so much.
Thanks.
And now I want you to try and imagine the unimaginable.
On the 9th of October, 2012, the Taliban shot me on the left side of my forehead. They shot my friends too. They thought that the bullet would silence us, but they failed.
Ms. Malala Yousafzai, I am writing to you in my personal capacity. This may not be the opinion or policy of Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan, or other jihadi faction or group.
Thousands of people have been killed by the terrorists, and millions have been injured. I'm just one of them. So here I stand, one girl among many. I speak not for myself, but for those without voice can be heard.
I heard about you through BBC Urdu service for the first time when I was in Banu prison. At that time, I wanted to write you to advise you to refrain from anti-Taliban activities you were involved in, but I could not find your address. What you're listening to there is an almost unimaginable conversation in a manner of speaking. A conversation between a Taliban terrorist and one of his victims, a schoolgirl senselessly brutalized, shot, and left for dead, and a member of the group who proudly took credit for her attack.
The terrorists thought that they would change my aims and stop my ambitions. But nothing changed in my life except this. Weakness, fear, and hopelessness died. Strength, power, and courage was born.
That, of course, is Malala Yousafzai, who spoke last week at the United Nations. You may have heard her words on a day declared for her and the victims of terrorism. While recovering from her near-fatal wounds, she received, amidst all of the notes of support and recovery from around the world, a letter from a Taliban commander. This letter found its way to media outlets in London who authenticated it as from a real, very much wanted Pakistani Taliban outlaw who goes by the name of Commander Adnan Rashid. "I was thinking how to approach you," he wrote, "with real or pseudo name. My all emotions were brotherly for you because we belong to same Yousafzai tribe. When you were attacked, it was shocking for me. I wished it would never happen, and I advised you before." Rashid seems to be trying to make the point in his letter that he is hurt and misunderstood. He seems particularly sensitive about how other people describe his religious beliefs. "First of all, please mind that Taliban never attacked you because of going to school or you were education lover. Also, please mind that Taliban or Mujahideen are not against the education of any men or women or girl."
They think that God is a tiny little conservative being who'd send girls to the hell just because of going to school. The terrorists are misusing the name of Islam and Pashtun society for their own personal benefits.
Rashid again. "If you were shot by Americans in a drone attack, would world have ever heard updates on your medical status? Would you be called daughter of the nation? Would the media make a fuss about you? Would General Kiani have come to visit you? And would the world media be constantly reporting on you? Would you be called to UN? Would a Malala Day be announced?" Malala again.
"Do remember one thing. Malala Day is not my day. Today is the day of every woman, every boy, and every girl who have raised their voice for their rights."
And Rashid concludes his letter. "At the end, I advise you to come back home, adopt the Islamic and Pashtun culture, join any female Islamic madrasa near your hometown, study and learn the Book of Allah, use your pen for Islam and plight of Muslim Ummah, and reveal the conspiracy of tiny elite who want to enslave the whole humanity for their evil agendas in the name of New World Order."
So let us wage a global struggle against illiteracy, poverty, and terrorism.
If there is such a global struggle, you can certainly hear the battle cry of both fronts in these two voices, speaking to each other, but perhaps not communicating in a message either will ever hear. The birthday of Nelson Mandela is a national and global holiday. He turns 95, but this day is about much more than the former South African leader, who's also a global symbol of the struggle for human rights. Two looks now at Mandela Day. First, as every school child in South Africa knows, this is a day of service.
Collecting the papers and all the rubbish, we're cleaning everything.
He means a lot. He's our father of South Africa.
We're doing it for Utata Mandela. He's done so much for South Africa, and that's our way of saying thank you, giving back to the community.
Voices there of students in a school in South Africa where people throughout the country are encouraged to volunteer 67 minutes of their time to help a charity or serve their community in some way. The 67 minutes represents the 67 years that Mandela served South Africa while in prison and in politics. Reporter Anders Kelto is the Africa correspondent for PRI's The World, produced by our partner WGBH. He joins us from Cape Town. Anders, welcome.
Thanks, John.
Now, you've been following a school in South Africa as part of a series for The World called The School Year. How has your school chosen to celebrate Mandela Day?
Well, the students decided that they wanted to clean up their community, so they split. There's about 500 students at the school, and they all branched out in different directions, and they basically got big black trash bags and rubber gloves and started picking up trash.
When you look at this tradition and the excitement and the way in which kids and schools approach this holiday, would you say this is a permanent gesture that's beginning to be woven really into society, or is it more symbolic?
I think at this point it's still largely symbolic. I think the idea is to use this day to get people hooked on community service so that they'll perform it year-round. But I think for the vast majority of people, it is just sort of a once-off kind of thing. But that being said, it does have powerful symbolic value, and people really do use this opportunity as a day to celebrate Mandela and to celebrate his legacy.
And in many ways, the school that you're profiling is part of this notion of service that comes directly out of Mandela's idea of government. Describe the school.
Yeah, so the school is in a township called Khayelitsha, which is a huge urban township just outside of Cape Town. There's about 600,000 people that live in this one township, and 70% of them live in shacks, metal and wooden shacks. It's a very, very tough place to grow up, and the school system there is very bad. This school that I'm following, however, has an incredible track record. Most years, every single senior graduates, and 70% of them go on to universities. So I've been spending time at the school getting to know the students and getting to know the teachers and telling their stories so that our listeners can get a sense for what it's like to grow up in a township in South Africa.
What are the kids saying today? What have you seen as kids go about this 67 minutes of service?
Well, they were having a lot of fun with it. There's a lot of singing and goofing around, but also hard work. The neighborhood around the school is often littered with trash. People just don't really care about how the area looks. And so these kids every day walk by heaps of trash and trash scattered here and there across open fields.
You know, we tend to throw papers away. Like, a person just throws a paper on the floor without caring. Then it becomes very dirty, and then no one picks that up. When you live in a dirty place, you try to make a difference in every way that you can.
And so they wanted to clean up, and they wanted to have fun while they were doing it. And the teachers and the students all seemed to really be enjoying themselves.
Reporter Anders Kelto is the Africa correspondent for PRI's The World, produced by our partner WGBH. Happy Mandela Day, Anders.
To you too, John.
Thanks so much. Here in the studio with me is Nsepeng Motema, who's a freelance journalist from South Africa, living here in New York. How drawn are you to listening to Anders there and with thoughts of home on this day?
Hello. I miss home. I sort of think of what I could be doing right now if I was back home. The past 2 years, I celebrated Mandela Day, went out with friends, with colleagues, helping out. I remember 2 years ago, we went to an orphanage home and we just offered our services. They were renovating and we just picked up paints and started painting around and played with the children. And now that I'm here, there's a disconnect. Definitely, I must say, but I'm still am celebrating. I'll go out and possibly do something here in New York.
Well, we might count the couple of minutes that we talk as part of your 67 minutes, perhaps.
My service for the day.
This is a tradition that's really a part of your life for many, many years. It's not just something you do offhand.
It is a part of my tradition, but I think for me what Mandela Day really means is I think we go on forgetting that so many people actually fought for my freedom and so many people died for it. Just to have that one day where you go out and you help someone and also, you know, say I give back and also appreciate that actually I'm here today because someone else dedicates so much of their time and their life to the struggle for freedom in South Africa.
You know, we've had weeks now of this Mandela holding on and his health significantly improving. It's almost as though the whole nation of South Africa has had a moment to really think about what it will be like when he's gone. And this letting go process that I think was pretty terrifying 2 months ago, is it different now?
It certainly is different for me personally. And I also think it's different for a lot of people. The one thing about us as South Africans is that we've had this very unhealthy dependency on Mandela for the longest time. As some sort of magician who could single-handedly solve our country's problems, I think that's why we sort of held on for so long. But because we do understand he's an old man, he's been lying in hospital for a very long time now, he spent so many years in prison to begin with, I don't think we want to see him continue holding on. I think we've started to let go. And hopefully, said as it sounds and as it makes me feel, that he could also let go too.
So in a sense, the message on this Mandela Day for many South Africans, perhaps all South Africans, is we're on our own with lots of problems, but we're on our own now.
I think it's more a thank you. We appreciate what you have done for us. I think for a while we thought that you are the man who's going to lead us to the promised land. But it's time that we as South Africans find our own way to the promised land. We cannot keep holding on to Mandela to be the one that leads us everywhere. It's not possible. He's only human after all. So it's a thank you, really.
Well, by my count, you have about 63 of your 67 minutes to go on this Mandela Day. Ntsopeng Motema, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ntsopeng Motema is a freelance journalist from South Africa living in New York.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Consider now the burdens people carry from summers past. You've got them. I know you do. Regrets. I know what you did last summer. I also know what you didn't do one summer long ago.
This is Nadia from Brooklyn. I tried to read Anna Karenina a couple years ago because Oprah told me it was a great idea. And it's like 1,000 pages, and I was trying to get through it, but I just thought it was so boring. And there were like 25 characters. There was no plot. I could not get it. I put it down halfway through. So that was it for me and Anna.
Thanks for sharing there, Nadia. Ah, the best laid plans of reading Americans as the summer begins and the ambitions are fresh and maybe a little oversized. When you start something, you just can't finish.
My name is Lyndon. I'm calling from Stillwater, Oklahoma. And the book that I could not finish was Communion by Whitley Strieber.
This is Joshua from Bushwick. P.D. James' Children of Men was such a creative idea, but executed through tired, boring prose. I'm sad each time I tell someone not to read it.
A lot of sharing here from you guys about unfinished books. Moby Dick, I could put it down, said a listener from Florida. And anything by James Joyce, he may be one of the greatest authors of our time. I guess greatest unreadable authors of our time, according to that listener. Minnesota listener has a blurb for Angela's Ashes. I got halfway through thinking it had to get better. At the three-quarter point, I'd had enough. Yikes. Colorado listener, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, heap of torture. And from New Jersey, 50 Shades of Grey, I made it through about 40 pages. Patrick Henry Bass, books editor for Essence, joins us now at the risk of angering all of the publishers on his BlackBerry with a list of this summer's books to put down. Patrick, welcome.
Always good to see you, John.
You finished Anna Karenina, right?
I did finish Anna Karenina.
There, so
yes,
did I.
Absolutely, yeah. What year was that? Last year, John?
No. I've actually read it a few times. I don't know why. I'm obsessed with the Russians. I'm a huge Tolstoy, Dostoevsky fan, so I've read those monsters.
I have a confession. I haven't completed War and Peace, but the rest of them I have. I know. Off with my head, but it's a true confession.
So any other books you haven't finished?
To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf, which is
a tough one.
Impossible. Yeah. The Unconsoled by Kuzo Ishiguro, which I'm not sure if anyone's finished that one.
No comment.
And I finished Mason and Dixon by Thomas Pynchon, but I haven't finished Gravity's Rainbow.
You know, I'm just starting Gravity's Rainbow. Pynchon is tough, but he delivers rewards if you stick with it.
He does. And I was looking at some movies on TCM, and it's amazing – how integral books were to popular culture, like films in the 30s, like you could see The Thin Man and someone was, you know, reading a novel, or watch Suspicion, where John Fontaine's character, the novel, plays a key role in that film. And, you know, again and again, you could watch films and you could just see characters, you know, sort of Deborah Carr, you know, putting a book down, you know, seeing people reading, and just, you know, in the last 10 years,
it's more of a fringe activity
on the screen. Right. Right, absolutely.
Which is a terrifying thought for the book editor for Essence, right?
And even I was thinking of the Twilight Zone episode with Burgess Meredith, the very famous episode in which, you know, he just wants to be alone to read his books. And what's happened to our culture, John?
Well, that's a much longer segment.
Yes,
of course.
You have
some titles, though, of books we should put down or might be forgiven for putting down this summer.
Absolutely. So what's happened in publishing is the summer has become a big blockbuster period for publishers to make money. And you and I are of the age under 40 where we remember where authors would go on The Tonight Show, like Jacqueline Suzanne and others, and Judith Krantz, you know, even Sidney Sheldon would go on and talk about these spectacular potboilers and these, you know, over-the-top adventures that they would create, suspense, romance, all of that.
Never could get through Judith
Never
Krantz,
could get through Jackie Collins. Anyway, all these people. Yeah. And so the summer is that period. But what I want to do is to give people a shortcut for some books that they should avoid, starting with Inferno by Dan Brown. First of all, he has enough money, right?
Right. You know, he doesn't need your help.
And the book is already number one. And I just think with Snowden and so many other subjects making headlines, like let's avoid him at all costs.
I'm a snob, but I loathe Dan Brown. I'm a big Umberto Eco fan, Name of the Rose.
Yes.
I love that kind of version of Catholicism. Inferno, Dan Brown, all of his stuff.
In high school, I thought that the Celestine Prophecy was just, I thought it was outstanding. So, yes, avoid at all costs,
all
Inferno.
Right.
And then avoid, I know some listeners may disagree, but avoid Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls by David Sedaris.
I'm going to say
that because most of what's in that collection has already been in The New Yorker, and David Sedaris has been much more clever in other collections. Get the audio book for that, but avoid that and, you know, pick up something else. Pick up Sisterland by Curtis Sittenfeld, which is a very layered narrative, I would say,
Sedaris may be phoning it in with Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls.
Yeah, also,
a title that sounds like kind of jumping the shark a little bit.
Yeah. And I'm from North Carolina, so I get the stories.
Okay.
I think he's quite clever, quite wonderful, but the audiobook for that one.
Next.
Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan, which all of these, the reviewers are going crazy over this, over the top.
I like this one.
You know, I would like it more had I not stumbled upon a YouTube video interview that Ruby Wax of England did with Imelda Marcos. And once you see that, there's no other Crazy Rich Asian that you can see than Imelda Marcos with Ruby Wax. Just can't.
So you think Kevin Kwan's Crazy Rich Asians, which I love, is derivative?
I think it's overhyped. I think it's
good. Long.
I don't think it's great. I think that one can wait for the fall to read that. I don't think one has to read that one right now. But he's getting amazing buzz and amazing attention. And, you know, who am I to argue with the buzz and the attention?
Well, I'm pro Kevin Kwan on this one. Final title?
Revenge Wears Prada by Lauren Weisberger, which The Devil Wears Prada was already a mediocre novel to begin with. The screenplay for The Devil Wears Prada was far superior.
The movie
was unbelievable, which had very little to do with the novel in many ways. And so why return with a sequel to a very mediocre novel?
But if it gets Meryl Streep back on screen doing that character again, I'm all for it.
And Emily Blunt as well. We hope so. To the literary gods, we hope.
Why,
but not for this book.
Why do people not finish books? And why do they embrace too ambitious goals for the summer that are going to end up disappointing them, scarring them for life?
Well, time is not on a lot of people's side. And also, I think that a lot of people go into these ambitious novels without a real sense of what the novel's goals are. And so they're trying to impress their friends or they just feel like this is on their bucket list and they have to do it. And you have to give time to narratives like The Other House by Henry James, which I completed 2 years ago. And The Putmesser Papers by Cynthia Ozick. I struggled with that novel. I thought that I was going to knock that one out. Like, no one knocks out Cynthia Ozick, but I thought I would complete that in a relatively short period of time. And I just completed that novel a week ago.
Well, Patrick Henry Bass knocks out Cynthia Ozick. That's a good blurb for you, I'd say. Good luck this summer. Do you have a blockbuster recommendation that's on the positive side to end on a positive note here for this summer?
The Puttermaster Papers, because I finally completed it. I would say please download that one as quickly as possible and see how quickly you can read that. It took me 2 years to finish that one. If you can top me in 2 years, please let us know at thetakeaway.org.
A challenge from Patrick Henry Bass, books editor for Essence. Have a great summer.
You too.
That's right. Keep the stories coming. What's on your do not read list or could not complete list? Listener in Dallas, the book that was too much, 100 Years of Solitude, supposedly life-changing for everyone else on the planet, but the political detail was too much for me. I still feel like I missed out on something special. A giant hole in your life there. Classics also proved tough for a listener in Florida who wrote, for me, it's War and Peace. I feel like an ignoramus not to have read it. I've tried several times, always fail about one-third of the way in. You know, there's a classic comic book of War and Peace. You can read that, and you've got it. You nail it. That's all you got to do. We always want to hear from you. Be a part of our listener response network. Sign up for our texts. You get one a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's show. Just text the word START to 69866. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.